This is a Pinball News production.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Rob and Mike for having us here this year. This is the 30th anniversary, and congratulations for having such a successful and long-running show.
Yeah, congratulations.
It's really kick-ass. You guys do a fantastic job.
Let's give it a round of applause. And we love those big diamonds. Those things are awesome.
So what we thought we'd do is talk about where the Pinball Museum is today and where we're going. We have some pretty ambitious plans for a new space, and have a short video to show you as well. But you guys are all, I think, pretty familiar with our mission, which is to preserve and promote an interest in art, science, and history, and also to preserve pinball. So we want to be not just an arcade, but an educational experience as well.
Hey, that works. So what we started off as initially, actually, did that skip a slide? Might have. I'll just go ahead. Our basic thing is teaching through pinball, teaching science, art, and history. We started out basically as an arcade to play pinball, and then we realized that there wasn't any preservation happening. So that got added to the list. So we do teaching and preservation of pinball, and that's our basic goal. Oops, there we go. So the way it started was it says 11 years ago. I think it was 12 years ago. We started as Lucky Juju, which there was no place to play pinball where I lived, electromechanical pinball specifically. And it was even hard to find the modern games, but I was really more interested in the earlier games. So we rented a room, and Jim Gruber and I basically hosted a Saturday night thing where you just came in, $5 in the jar, and you played pinball and bring your own beer. And it was very, very loose, and it was kind of a cult thing that got stimulated by an art show that we did. And then that all of a sudden brought a lot of people from San Francisco and the whole Bay Area in there. Some of the things that we've done is we kept expanding it because it was popular, and it was new to the Bay Area. Bay Area hadn't seen pinball for, I don't know, 15 years. So it just caught on, and it was great. We just kept expanding it, and we had to do it by removing the coin mechs because it was actually illegal where we lived to have an arcade. So it was all based on coin drops. So we circumvented that by taking the coin mechs out and doing it on free play and doing it through a jar. After that, I started teaching at the Crucible about how to work on these machines. I kind of owe that to Clay Harrell, watching his videos. I don't know if everybody's seen his Shaggy videos, but I just thought, wow, so a knucklehead like that can do it. I think anybody can do it.
So for those of you who don't know, we actually put on our own exposition, the Pacific Pinball Exposition, for 6 years in a row. I think the high water mark for number of games that we had there under one roof was about 425 1 year. We had about 22,000 square feet and some seminars and things like that. So it was quite fun. What we really wanted to do is show what our permanent home for a museum would look like. You know, people would come to this show and they say, oh, is this the museum? Well, no, but this isn't the museum. This is kind of what we want it to look like eventually. Right now we have room for, we have 900 machines in our collection as a whole, but this current space we're in has room for about 110 to be set up and played at any time, so we rotate in and out. But what we'd really like to do is, if you were to walk into the Smithsonian, for example, what would you expect to see? You'd want to see some of the oldest games from each decade. You'd want to have a gift shop, a restaurant, an oral history section so you could learn, hear stories from designers and artists who made these things. So that's what we want to have ultimately under one roof. So let's see.
My background was an exhibit builder for the Exploratorium. So one goal of this was to always become a nonprofit, but also to start building exhibits using pinball machines. Was being sent all over fixing these science exhibits. And it just occurred to me that, geez, pinball machines handle abuse from the public pretty well. And I thought, what if he made pinball exhibits or science exhibits out of pinball parts? They might last a little longer. So that's kind of where that concept came from. And out of that, we built the clear pin and then started building some of these kinetic pieces that are somewhat science-oriented and somewhat art-oriented, just basically to attract and entertain people. And then we got this idea that, wow, it'd be cool to bring pinball to places that don't have it. And so we built the little Juju, which was a Spartan Manor that we put hydraulic feet on and battery power, and we actually took it camping. I remember we really pissed off those campers at 2 in the morning when we were playing pinball, and they were wondering where we were getting our electricity from. But it's great because this little trailer goes all over, and it has 5 pinball machines and a jukebox in it, and it has done a lot for spreading the love of pinball. People just love to see the little Juju pull up. It had 12 batteries and an inverter that I traded for a Xenon or something. It was a,
trade.
I think that was a Xenon. And somebody who worked for the cable company had a bunch of batteries that I guess were out of date. So I snagged all of those and the inverter, and that's how it was powered. It would run about 4 hours. I'm trying to upgrade it so that it'll run for 10 hours and hopefully be solar powered. Try and do that with a grant.
This is a shot of our restoration and research facility, aka the warehouse, where we keep the games that aren't set up in the actual museum itself. And as I said before, we have upwards of 900 games now in the collection. And obviously, we have a backlog of quite a few games to go through, but I would say out of the 900, we have about half of them that have been restored and actually working. But what we don't want to have happen is that for them to just sit unassembled in the dark. That's not doing anybody any good. It's not fair to the games. It's not fair to you as an audience and the people that are meant to play and enjoy these things. And when they are set up and restored, they're kinetic. They're interactive. They're meant to be enjoyed and played, not set up behind velvet ropes. So for us, it's important to really get these out there, get them fixed up, and get them out there and enjoy it in the public.
So we have a little shop in the museum where we have all our parts and stuff, and then a couple of exhibit shops that we work at building exhibits. And once at my brother Christian's shop, and he's a neon fabricator, so... He's able to make some of these parts that we need. A lot of the stuff we do is we do a lot of community service. It used to bother me a lot. My wife tends to give away admissions at the drop of a hat, and I used to like, why are we going to make any money and keep this thing going? But it all works out in the end. I she's really taught me a lesson about how to be generous and just. Any nonprofit, any school group that asks for auction tickets or anything, we immediately send them these tickets. And what it does is we have a lot of kids and a lot of families visit our museum, and it's really paid off in the total community interaction and in raising a whole nother generation of pinheads. One of the most amazing things that happened. I was there, and this little kid comes in with his mom, and he proudly, he's real excited. And he goes, my mom doesn't even know what a pinball machine is. Can you believe that? And I looked at him and said, kid, I can't believe you know what one is. I was kind of surprised. So it's really having an effect. And the other thing that we do is when you come into the museum, the first thing you see is a brief history of pinball with a parlor bagatelle leading up to a bally bumper that leads up to a metro. And then you can begin to play the flipper games, which is mainly Larry's collection of wood rails and then a whole collection of wedge heads and Williams and bally machines from the 60s. But it's all by chronological order. And we did that so that people get their first experience with pinball would be some of the old ones that nobody gets to see or play. And the reason behind that is they appeal to kids. The kids like the simpler, older ones, and it's kind of surprising. It used to be a lot of people would head right to the back room where all the modern machines is, but now it's pretty evenly distributed.
It is. It's funny, too. Young kids come in and they'll say, look, Mom, look, Dad, they made a pinball machine based after the video game version.
Yeah.
A lot of times that's the first one they saw.
Yeah, a lot of kids didn't even know that they were real. They saw them on a computer and that's where they played them, and they thought, wow, we went to a lot of trouble to actually build this thing that was on a computer. So
describe
fun.
Briefly just the library program, Mike, how that works.
Oh, yeah, we have a library program that, I think it's 7 counties around the Bay Area that it's every day a family can print a pass for their family to come visit the pinball museum for free. And we probably estimate, forget exactly how many people, but it is a lot of people. At the end of the year, we get a tally of how many people printed these up and came, and I was surprised at how effective it is. A lot of people that can't afford, to come into the museum will get one of those passes. We also let anybody who wants to come in and just learn about pinball, we open the door. Yeah, you can come on in. If you want to play the games, we ask that you pay admission, but you're free to look and study all you want. So by opening up the doors, it really, really does help a lot with spreading the pinball love. We get a lot of nonprofits coming through, and a lot of school groups come through to either teach aesthetics. There's science classes. Excuse me. My wife Koshik, a physics professor, teach a class on Fridays to school groups using pinball physics to demonstrate Newtonian physics. I was teaching waveforms and electricity, and we use it as much as we can to teach whatever curriculum we need to teach. Eric Koss, one of our volunteers, is developing a whole history course where he's talking about history through pinball, looking at the back glasses and basically taking you through the museum and going through history as it's presented on the pinball back glasses. Yeah, we have a mural program that's pretty amazing. It was started by Dan Fonts. He's the one on the right painting a mermaid. And in it are Eric Koss, Ed Castle, and Darcy Bruno. Darcy just finished this incredible 10-foot by 10-foot mural of Captain Fantastic. I wish Dave was here. It would blow his mind. It's amazing. It's real stunning. All the murals are just amazing. They're hand-painted, and I guess a lot of people think, well, why don't you just print them? It's just not the same. They're hand-painted. When you blow them up that big, you're going to have to fill in a lot of detail that would get lost in a printing. And it's all on canvas. It just takes on a whole other life when it's done that way. And they're pretty amazing. At the last PPE, we had 24 of them displayed, and it was quite stunning.
So this is a picture of our board of directors. As we said, we're a 501c3. There's 12 of us on the board, and I think it's a very sort of eclectic kind of group. We have blue collar, white collar, no collar members, but we all share a very strong passion, as it were, sort of an unhealthy appreciation of a collection of restoration and preservation of pinball machines is the one thing that we all do have in common.
We have lots of volunteers. In fact, some of them are here today. And that is a key factor. We got asked that yesterday about the show. We'd get 120 volunteers to put on that show. And just in running the museum, we do a Monday night. We're closed on Monday, so that's when we fix them. And we have some Monday night fix-it thing where we call in the pros, led by Chris Koontz. He's famous out where we are as one of the best pinball repair people ever. But these are dedicated people from a lot of them, like someone from Google, eBay, Yahoo. A lot of the tech firms have people that just love to work on pinball, and they all share their love, and we all get together for pizza at 8 o'clock, and we just fix machines. Daniel comes down here. He's in the front row with his father, Dennis, and they work on machines. And Lavina helps, professional glass cleaner. And Brad helps out, but he's on our board, so I can't really say anything about that. And like I said, we have a lot of volunteers. David Volansky's come on board, and that's Chris and his brother Andy. They've been involved with pinball and arcade amusements for, I think, right out of college. I think you've actually skipped out part of college to do that. We got a couple of important collections handed to us. One was from Gordon Hossie, and that was back in 2009. He was basically losing his storage, and he saw where we were going and what we wanted to do, the fact that we were really dedicated to preserving the older machines, and so he donated his entire collection to us.
And that more or less consisted of every single-player Gottlieb game made from stage door canteen through a photo finish in 1960 or 61. So very important collection. On the right, you see a slide of a slice of Richard Conger, who's very well-known in the Bay Area as a collector of 20s and 30s games. He has upwards of 1,200 machines that he's more or less committed to donating to us in phases. When he reaches a certain age milestones, he's beginning to reach that age now. His collection is unique, and many are one of a kind, especially the 1930s games and the pre-war games, things people have never even seen before. And those will look really outstanding if when we do occupy this new space that we've been talking about.
And speaking of that, this is so. What we're doing to move ahead with this is, and a lot of people unfortunately believe that we've already moved into the Carnegie, which unfortunately is not the case. We're dealing with a city, municipality, so these things take time. And we're really happy to announce that we have completed an ENA, which is an exclusive negotiation agreement, and we've signed off on that. It's gone to the city, and they finally made a date with the city council for November 5th. Larry and I will go in front of the city council and seek approval for this project. And we're, I'd say, 99% assured that they're going to approve it. After being there for 12 years, we've become the number two destination in Alameda. The number one is the Hornet, which is the floating museum. So we're number two. The city recognized that, you know, we kind of grew up out of this little hole in the wall, and people come from all over to come to the museum. So they really wanted to support us, and they offered us a Carnegie Library that was built in 1902. It was the third Carnegie Library built in California. It was closed in the 80s, I think 87. Then they started to rebuild it and earthquake retrofit it. And they put about $4.5 million into that building. They did an incredible job. You can't even see the reinforcements that they did, but it's totally bulletproof. They put a new roof on it. What's lacking is electrical, because it's 1902, so they didn't really have thorough electricity. It had no lighting. It uses a skylight that a natural light would come in. They actually had a glass-floored stacks so the light could filter through. That was real common. This is one of the last libraries to have one of those glass-floored stacks. So it needs lighting, needs ventilation, needs an elevator. We'd have to put in loading dock, freight elevator, and service elevator, ADA-compliant bathrooms, ramps, all the great stuff that the city's going to require, you know, for us to be a real institution. And for that, they're asking us to raise $3.5 million. We've upped it to $4 million because this was all done back in 2007 is when they came up with these estimates. And we've got even further. We want to put a small restaurant, serve beer and wine down in the basement, and have a gift shop. All the things that Larry had mentioned. So what we hope when you come back on November 5th is to have this passed and we'll be able to go ahead with it.
So this would allow us to have room for about 275, maybe 300 machines set up at once?
Yeah. A whole selection of Richard Conger's games that we hope to rotate in there. It'll all be categorized by era, and we hope to have displays, information, and a whole center area that's going to be for community art center so we can integrate with the community better.
And the building was actually used as the Alameda Public Library itself up until 1997, so it's been sitting vacant since then. And the key to the project is that the city really wants us in this building. I mean, it's right across the street from City Hall, which is kind of ironic if you think that pinball was illegal and sort of frowned upon for so many years.
Just less than a month ago, they made arcades legal in Alameda, which is kind of funny. We went to that meeting, and about a month before that, they made pinball legal in Oakland, which is kind of ironic because one of the key machines in our whole collection is a Bally Bumper that was confiscated by the Oakland police back in 1936. The Oakland police didn't know what to do with them. They were probably supposed to destroy them, but it was kind of like, you know, Mac computer back then. I mean, it was a high-tech piece of equipment. So they brought them over to Alameda, and they gave them to the Alameda cops as gifts. And that's where this one sat for 80 years until this older gentleman saw what we were doing and offered it to us, and so we bought it from him. It was his brother's. He happened to have one also. They were both cops, and he had his in his crawl space, so he used that for parts. But it's pretty amazing because it was in pristine shape, and it was contraband. I just thought it was pretty amazing that Oakland banned them and Alameda soaked them up. Because Alameda was kind of a black sheep town of the Bay Area. It was a party town where during Prohibition the booze would come into Alameda, and it was kind of a party town. Just real quick though, on the Carnegie, people wonder like why would you want to put pinballs in there? Some librarians are very upset about it. But if you saw the building, and we're going to show a short video of it after this, the whole concept is to lift pinball out of the pool halls and dark basements, et cetera, and actually elevate it, especially these early machines that are incredible forms of Art Deco. The artwork on these machines is incredible. Richard Conger's collection has never been seen by the public. He's got one-of-a-kind machines. So much of that, these machines have been destroyed. We're afraid that if they go into the private sector, we're never going to see them. And our whole mission is to preserve pinball for the public to experience. And we want them to experience it in an incredible environment. It'd be like taking the Mona Lisa and putting it in a cardboard mat frame. You know, it loses a lot of its aesthetics. You know, we want to put pinball in a really beautiful frame for people to see. Yeah, you got it.
So I see the map there. Can you tell us a little bit about where this is situated relative to downtown businesses, parking lots? So if we're coming into Alameda, are we right in the center of town, and where do we park, and how do we get there?
Well, it's funny. Where the museum is now is on Webster Street, which was a center of town when the Navy was there. And then this is the official downtown is the other side. Where we're moving is to the other side, which is the Park Street Business District. And it is right across from City Hall, literally. And so when you look at a map and you see what they're doing, where we'd like to be is the hub of this new cultural arts district, and they want to make us, you know, the hub of that. About a block down on the map, it's kind of hard to see because it's not a very good map. But when we roll the film, I think you get a better idea because it's much better location. It's got a public garage. There's parking all around it, but there's also a multi-level parking garage that they built to help with the theater. And the theater is a 1932 Art Deco theater that they've completely restored. So these two things go hand in hand. Alameda is a town that really features a lot of history and they've hung on to all of their Victorian houses. They have more Victorian houses in Alameda per capita than San Francisco. And it's because they enacted a law to save these things. So they've done a pretty good job of preservation.
And Alameda, for those of you who don't know, is about 10 miles south of Oakland, which is just across the bay from San Francisco itself.
Let's see. You want to run the video? I don't think the video is going to run. Is it? Martin, do you mind if it? Okay. By the way, this is a video that we shot that we're about ready to release as soon as we get approval from City Hall, and it's going to launch our...
Hi, I'm Michael Sheese from the Pacific Pinball Museum, and we need your help. I'm standing in the Alameda Carnegie Library, built in 1902. It's been vacant for 15 years, and thanks to the city of Alameda, we have an opportunity to make this into the new home for the Pacific Pinball Museum. Imagine this beautiful historic building filled with pinball machines from the 30s and 40s, science displays, art, and people all enjoying it. The city of Alameda has offered us the Carnegie for 30 years at a no-cost lease, but we have until June of 2016 in order to raise $4 million to complete this project. The Pacific Pinball Museum was founded by me over 12 years ago in its current location on Webster Street. A lot of time and energy went into making it the cool place that it is today. What you see in our current museum is only the tip of the iceberg. We're only able to show a tenth of our total collection. We have hundreds of machines in our warehouse with nowhere to live. Some are truly one of a kind, the only working versions in existence. The goal of the Pacific Pinball Museum is to preserve and protect these precious American cultural icons and to educate the public about the history, science, and art behind these fantastic machines. The Pacific Pinball Museum has been bringing mirth to the Bay Area for 12 years. Imagine what we could do with an incredible space like this. It would be the most innovative museum in the entire Bay Area. But we need your help to make this happen. A donation of any amount gets us closer to our goal, so please give generously.
I think we're going to go run into the visible pinball, which is a big feature of the museum, and it's here at the expo.
Our next speaker teamed up with Wade Krause to produce the most unusual machine, the first ever visible pinball. Here to tell us about this remarkable project, please introduce Michael Sheese.
Hi, I was just out here for the PPM. So I'm Michael Sheese, and I was hoping Wade Krause, I know he's here, but I think he is about an hour outside, so he was staying with Tanya Kleiss. I was hoping he was going to be here because he was such a big part of this. I don't know if everybody's seen the visible pinball. Rob saw it up at the Northwest show and asked us to bring it out here. And so he shipped it out here for everybody to enjoy. It's the third one that we built. The second one actually ended up at the Exploratorium in San Francisco, and that was the science museum I used to work at. And it's kind of ironic because I used to build exhibits for them, and I was always bugging them, ooh, I got some ideas for exhibits, and they're like, shut up, kid, just build what's on your plate. And so after I quit, we start this museum and start building exhibits, and they're going, ooh, yeah, we want one of those. Would you build us one of those? And I was like, well, if you got the money. So they paid almost $50,000 for this one. And it sounds like a lot of money, but it took a hell of a lot of work and a lot of research and over a year to build just one of these. And then after we built the one, we were able to build a couple more. And they're really time-consuming. They're hand-assembled. The parts are machined, but everything is threaded, and so all that has to be done by hand. So there's Wade Krause, and we were the idea was like, why build one? One, it was an artistic statement. I mean, I just thought, wow, a clear pinball machine would be so cool to look at. But the other thing was, I was teaching pinball repair, and I was kind of getting tired of lifting the play field. So I thought, you know, this would save a lot of time. And it's an incredible teaching aid because you can, you know, watch it reset and just and see how everything works. A lot of people say, why Surf Champ? I chose Surf Champ because the artwork wasn't real offensive. I'm always thinking about families, and I want anybody to be able to enjoy this. So it had more playfield features on it than pretty much any other machine I'd found. And it only had a couple of bumpers. It had a spinner, drop targets. It had rollover lanes. It had the features like double bonus and extra ball and all those things, you know, made it, because those were all the things that I wanted people to look at and see how those mechanisms worked. And it was a really fun to play machine. So all those added up into that selection. My other selection was going to be Spacewalk and Countdown.
What year was Surf Champ?
Surf Champ is 1976, yeah. And so it was kind of state-of-the-art for electromechanical pinball machines, too. We put together a team starting with Wade Krause. I met Wade, and we started talking about he was actually silk screening back glass and starting to do play fields, making his own play fields. And this was kind of early on when nobody was doing this. And I asked him, well, would it be possible to make a clear pinball play field? And he thought it was, and we researched it, looked into getting the right kinds of plastics and the right cutters and everything. And at that point, Wade didn't have a CNC. He was using one of his instructors. So he was down in Fresno. So I had a buddy from the Exploratorium open up his own shop. That was Nathaniel Taylor. And he was willing to do the first test cuts on his. So we made a plywood version of it. The other people involved were Christian Schies, my brother. He and I worked together building exhibits. And Dick Falkard, he was our supervisor, and he's an amazing draftsperson. So he helped draft out the cabinet. So Wade Krause, boy, I wish he was here. They've actually done a little video on him called Wade Krause Pinball Artist. I don't know if everybody's seen that. He's pretty amazing. He's old school, doesn't take any shortcuts. He did the Metallica machine and the Beatnik's Coolsville machine that was sold to Metallica, the band. So he worked with Dirty Donnie, and he did a back glass that was... It beat Doug Watson's by 3 screens. I think his was 16 screens. He's probably going to say no, it was 18, but it was at least 16 screens to do the Beatnik's Coolsville, which is pretty amazing when you think about it, and an incredible, just very meticulous and attention to detail. So he's the one who actually I cleared off a Surf Champ playfield, sent it to him. And then he scanned it, and then scanned all the hole patterns, and was able to get a cutting program from that. And then, as I said, Nathaniel Taylor cut the first one. We cut a plywood version of it, checked it to make sure everything was spot on, and then we went straight to plastic. And it's an amazing... engineers, actually background is electronics, but he got into doing CNC, so he was a great choice for doing the first one. Dick Falkard laid out the cabinets for us, and he actually worked on some of the other clear pinballs that we've made after this. We did a Freedom machine, which we'll talk about later. Then my brother Christian, and that's him with the first playfield that we did. And the first playfield that we did, we decided we were just going to do it on one piece of plastic. We were going to silk screen just the outline, the key line artwork on there, so you could really see through the whole playfield and get a clear view of what was going on. So my brother's very skilled in working with plastic and all sorts of mediums. And then me, I basically came up with the idea and put a lot of sweat into it and a couple of machines. So Wade digitized the playfield and then broke out the key line, and that's what we laid down on the first one. Just dropped out all the color. And same thing with the back glass. Just dropped out all the color so you could see right through it. Now this one is the first one we built, and that's the one that's at the museum. And it's, you know, it's different. It doesn't have the color. I kind of like the color, but it is a lot better for explaining how things work. So we cut all the pieces at Nathaniel's for the first one. And then we went to Mr. Plastic for the cabinets and the ones we did afterwards. So with all that, they're all hand-fitted. And, you know, even though you CNC something, they can't thread holes. And threading holes in plastic, well, it's not easy. You break a few taps, and then you have to get them out. And it is pretty hard. There's a lot of little tricks, and it just takes patience and everything. And even after all that, you're still going to end up with some little idiosyncrasies that you have to correct. So we used PETG for the playfield itself and the mechanical board. I'm not going to go into a big lecture about plastics, but PETG is kind of this wonder plastic for me, because to have to hand tap all the holes on the mechanical board would have been insane. So we found this plastic that you can just, drill and then use a wood screw. We'll go into it, and it actually holds it better than wood, because after 6 years of constant use, the screws haven't loosened. It's pretty amazing. So the PETG was a great solution for the mechanical board and the play field. We used regular plexiglass for the cabinet. And then Wade Krause went ahead and did the plastic set for us, scanning all the artwork off that and making those clear. Tim Arnold coughed up a couple of clear bumper caps that somebody had given him that he just held on to. He didn't know what to do with them. And then when he heard we were building this clear pin, he goes, "Oh, well, you'll need these." So that's, and I think that's the only two in existence. Maybe I'm mistaken. One thing we did with the second generation is we decided, you know, the silkscreen artwork was wearing off. So our second version of that one, we had screened like four play fields. So the second one, when we rebuilt it, we put Mylar on top of it, and that saved that one. But for the color ones, what we did was we used a 3/8 PETG on the bottom. We used a Mylar for all the artwork in between, printed directly on that, translucent, and then we put a polycarb top on it. So it ends up the original half inch thick, and everything fits just like it should be, and it'll never wear out. Unfortunately, we did do one version before that where we actually screened onto the back of the polycarb, and it's unfortunately a little flimsy and tends to wear off, especially if it's not cleaned properly. So I think the Mylar is the way to go on that. My brother Christian's also a neon artist, so he put in the neon that's in the bottom, and he can tune the color on it. So it ended up being the nice lighting solution for that. So we've taken the clear pin all over. Pin Game Journal did a cover on it. Jim was really excited about that when it came out. By the way, right next to it, you can see the Helicopters game, which was the first I think that I'll probably get hammered on this later, but I think it's one of the first custom, totally scratch built. They took a kingpin. I guess it's one of the first non-commercial custom pins that somebody built, at least that I'd ever heard of. And that's kind of how I got to know Wade and Dirty Donnie. So it was kind of fun to set those up together because everybody worked on those. So it debuted in 2007 at our show. It's been to the TED Talks, the Google I.O., and a few of the high-tech companies. They always want to grab that, the clear pin. And we make them pay dearly for it, especially Google. We did a great show for Google, and we had 10 pins set up, and it was pretty amazing because I wanted to do the whole gamut, and Chris Koontz helped me set it up. So we had the clear pin on one end, and then Adam's family, and down the road, down to electromechanicals, and then the first machine we had was Rockola's World Series. So you have all these high-tech engineers there. This is a Google I.O. And they got talking robots and cars driving around inside the Moscone Center by themselves, you know, and all this high-tech crap. And all the engineers are at our booth playing World Series. I just thought that was pretty ironic. It was a mechanical machine, and they were just fascinated by it. They liked the clear pin, too, but... go out in the lobby and see the clear pin. There's something right next to it that I don't think anybody's paying attention to, but it's really pretty cool. It is a little kiosk that we built to go along with the clear pin, and it's got a computer animation by Steve Fury. And it's just something that Jem Gruber found on the internet, and I looked into it, and I was just like, wow, it's a whole explanation of the reset of a Gottlieb machine of this era. And he basically broke it all apart, and one of the clever things he did is it's always hard to explain the timing sequence. So he took the score motor and he broke it into three separate little cams so that you can watch them all working at the same time and see the switches. So it's kind of a fantasy test bed, and it explains in no uncertain terms how the reset sequence. I mean, we refer to it when we get stuck, like when a machine is doing the, you know, and you got to find out, well, what's hanging up the reset? And it's just amazing. If you get a chance, it's like 22 minutes to go through it, but it's really amazing. He also explains how a flipper works in another one that's on that little kiosk. David Vlansky managed to shrink the video down and put it into one of those little frames, and just made a display out of it. So if you get a chance, it's kind of neat to see that. I'm sorry? It is on YouTube. It's pretty poor quality, and because YouTube tends to they shrink it, and they, you know, so it's unfortunately not very pleasant to watch. That's why I wrote Steve Fury and I said, "Hey, this would be a great teaching aid," you know. And he saw our visible pin. He said, "Yeah, this would be perfect." So he very graciously, you know, said, "Yeah, here's a high res version that I did that I can't show on YouTube." And so. Yeah, and then he's actually helping us work on one about bumpers. And so we're trying to complete a bunch of exhibits for the museum and for touring that will explain how things work in a pinball machine. The one thing that we don't talk about here, we made two other versions of the visible pin off the Bally Freedom. So it was a whole other remake of a cabinet because it's a Bally. And we used a Freedom electromechanical and a Freedom solid state version of it, and they're set up side by side so that you can see the same exact machine, same play field and art, and how they went from electromechanical to solid state, because that Freedom was the first solid state commercially successful computer controlled pinball machine. If you ever look at the Alltech boards and you set the dip switches, Freedom is 000, you know, it's the first one. So it's kind of interesting. And that's about it. Yeah, Dave.
First of all, on the point of the total re-themes of an existing game, I'm sure you're aware of Michael Brown's Gold Girl, or you go
Yeah, we were trying to get, Michael Brown's a friend of mine, he's at the Exploratorium. And I know that, I believe that came out here once, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we were trying to get it out here again, but I could, he just couldn't do it in time.
Yeah,
I'm here.
What's that?
Michael Brown's You Go Girl is starting with, it's a Earth Shaker, I think.
Yeah, I believe it was.
And Total Reboot, the art, the electronics, he actually has a completely separate second electronic system, so certain targets, scoring compared to two switches, one for the original scoring and one for his features. And it's got a camera and a monitor, and it's kind of takes a picture of the player.
Yeah, you step into the high heels to play it. I think if you complete certain objectives, then you get, it takes a picture of you, and you get to try on different wigs.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of, it's what? Well, I'm afraid he is. He's an artist and an exploratorium. I don't know what they call those people, tinkers, I guess.
And I have a question also. So in the visible thing that's here, I noticed that you have the relay labels in their original position using the original label paper strips there. I was wondering if you had thought about any additional labeling that would increase the education of that.
Yeah, I have. And actually, we want to finish the back glass too, because it's missing some information that's kind of lost, like the tilt, because of the nature of how they screen the back glass and what you can pull off. So we actually want to go back and do that and do more complete labeling. Yeah.
I've been to two of the shows. I love them. Are you going to do any more of that first?
Oh, the PPE, you mean? No, probably not. The PPE was basically to show people what we wanted to do. And
Were they positive cash flow?
They were, but it's kind of like the amount of work you put into it. If we had done car washes, we would have been millionaires. So it was an incredible amount of work. And our intent wasn't really We thought that people needed to see the early machines. They were sorely underrepresented, and Larry was an incredible force in providing these early machines. And because our goal is to preserve pinball and represent all of pinball, so the early stuff gets left off the table, unfortunately, and it's really important to us because that's the part that's going to go into private collections, and once it does, the public will not be able to see it. The Smithsonian isn't doing any pinball. No major institutions are doing any pinball. I'm not trying to, pat us on the back too hard, but it's a tougher road to hoe because if you go into any of these the other museums or arcades, they don't have the early machines in any quantity. They might have one or two wood rails just to show you this is what it looks like. We maintain at least 10 to 20 wood rails to play so that people can experience them and really look at the artwork and immerse themselves in it. And it's funny, it has spawned a whole new generation that prefers the early machines. One little friend, Ben, that's all he plays. He comes out from Memphis and he doesn't want to play new machines. He wants to play the older machines.
My second question was going to be, you're obviously way out on the West Coast. I'm trying to figure out ways to get the whole country involved. One of the things I thought of was, since you are into education, was developing education, you're making them teach art, you can teach electronics, you can teach logic, you can teach all kinds of things for people. I would think that would be a natural way to get the whole world, get the whole country involved.
Yeah, and we do teach those things. My wife's heading up the science and pinball, working with this physics professor, and it's kind of just located in Alameda right now. I'm working on these pinball exhibits, one dealing with generators. You light these bumper caps, and it explains about energy and power, about logic using series and parallel switches. So we developed all these exhibits, but the grants haven't been forthcoming, and it takes money to do this. So we had an opportunity, strangely enough, from Germany. They want a pinball show. They came out, saw what we were doing. They really liked it. So they scheduled one for 2015. And then we started talking more. There's a lot more that we want to do for them. So we're actually going to work on it for another year. And it's probably going to go to Wolfsburg, the Fainer Museum in Wolfsburg first, and then to the Technorama in Switzerland, and do a European tour, which kind of is a little sad because I was hoping that it would be in America where it would really take off, but the Europeans seem to show more interest in it right now.
I was thinking more of a video presentation.
Oh.
Something of that nature.
Yeah.
Going to every school.
Yeah, that's true. That'd be another thing to do. It takes money, you know.
Wonderful education.
They're very hard to get. If anybody, you know, one area where we really need help is grant writing. We've got a few grants, but nothing like what we'd like to get. So, yeah, all this, unfortunately, takes money. We started out as a nonprofit in 2004, 2 years after we opened up. We got our nonprofit status, so... yeah, that's where we're going to really need help. Because we think it's important. It's an important part of American culture. I know Rob's cutting us off. Thanks, everybody, for coming to this.
Thank you very much.
And again, thanks to Rob and Mike for putting on this wonderful show.